calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
71%! That's the percentage, the number of Americans who disapprove of George W. Bush's handling of the Iraq War, an all-time high, according to the new AP Ipsos poll. George Bush told by the Iraq Study Group, essentially, you're going to have to talk to Syria, you're going to have to talk to Iran. Yes, during the Cold War, we talked to the Soviet Union. In fact, we even installed a special telephone so that the president could talk to the premier of the Soviet Union, who had all those nuclear weapons pointed at us, because you talk to your enemies if you want to avoid war. And we did, and it worked. And eventually the Soviet Union collapsed. But Bush says, now we know. We're going to talk to them. Now we're not going to talk to them. Bad news. The president's response to the Iraq Study Group. And we will get into, as we go on in the day, also the Iraq Study Group's recommendation that the oil be privatized. Yeah, let's bring in ExxonMobil. They'll do a fine job in Iraq. Indeed. So we'll see where all this goes. Welcome to the program, by the way. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. It is the first hour of our Friday program, and thus, as always, we start our first hour of Friday program with Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator-elect Bernie Sanders. I think of Bernie as America's Senator-elect. He's the only independent in the House of Representatives. He'll be one of two independents in the Senate. The other one we won't name. And we're so glad to have you with us. It's
good
our brunch.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, Bernie. Our Brunch with Bernie segment here with Congressman Bernie Sanders from Vermont. Bernie, what's on your plate today?
I mean?
Hey, Bernie, you can hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, you're coming in on a cell phone, and it's breaking up a little bit. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yep, it just vanished. He's going to try. He's going to call us back and try and get on. I know Bernie's in motion. Let me just share with you a quote from Franz. We'll get back to Bernie in just a second. And, of course, when he does get on, he likes to take your phone calls. Our number, 1-866-440-8466, tomhartman.com, our website. A quote from Franz Jagerstatter. Franz Jagerstatter was an Austrian who in the 1940s, when the Anschluss happened, when Hitler took over Austria, was impressed into the military, and the second time refused to serve, was sent to the gallows for it. And he said, and I quote, "When a leader allows himself to break the rules of humanity, it is the duty of every citizen to break the leader's rules." As he was sitting at the gallows waiting to be hung, the bishop came to him and tried to talk him out of holding his position. But Franz Jagerstatter said, no, no. I'm going to take a principled position. Bernie, you're back.
Back on. We're on a landline. We should be good.
Okay, great, great. So what's on your plate this week?
Well, there's a lot. It's been a very interesting process getting oriented here for the Senate. It's gone through a number of orientation sessions, have the opportunity to meet with the chair people of the committees that I'm on, and I'm on some really exciting committees. I'm on the Health, Education, and Labor Committee with Senator Kennedy, which deals with some of the most important domestic issues facing our country, and it's a fairly progressive committee, and I'm excited about that. We're on the Environmental Committee with Senator Barbara Boxer, who is going to be the chair of it, and I think if there's any committee in the Senate which has undergone a major transformation in terms of addressing real issues, it's the Environmental Committee. Barbara Boxer will be a very strong environmentalist, replacing Senator Jim Inhofe, who is one of those people who doesn't even acknowledge the existence of global warming. So we expect some really good things there. I'm on the Energy Committee, which obviously is dealing with the major issue of how we move from fossil fuels and dependence on Mideast oil to sustainable energy, to energy efficiency. I would hope that we can make some really significant progress in that committee. I'm on the Budget Committee, which helps set national priorities. And the issue there is to make sure that those large corporations who have been getting corporate welfare, those people who, wealthy people who have avoided paying their fair share of taxes, do so that we have the money to address the enormous social needs in our country, that we do that. I'm on the Veterans Committee, And that's an area we have to move rapidly to make sure that veterans get the health care and the other benefits that they need. So it's, for me, a very exciting opportunity to begin to play a significant role in trying to shape America's priorities.
Boy, it sounds like a great start. There's a huge list there. And these are, by and large, all these the issues that you mentioned that are connected to these various committees that you're going to be on are issues that for 5.5, 6 years, the Republicans have been keeping bottled up. I mean, in many cases, not even allowing discussions of.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And the issue here, I think, the political issue, is that as Americans, we're going to have to stay tuned to what's going on. It takes 60 votes, as I think most people know, to get things passed the Senate because of cloture. People can continue debate indefinitely. You need 60 votes to stop that debate and move forward. And we need to put pressure on the Senate to create and fight for an agenda which is going to make sense to the middle class and working families of our country to protect the environment, to deal with Iraq and so forth. So I would hope that all of the listeners understand that while November 7th election day was certainly a good day. I think progressives ended up doing a lot better than we thought. We no longer have one-party government in Washington. Democrats control the Senate and the House. You have people like Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, very good people. But in order to do the right thing, there is going to have to be a lot of political movement at the grassroots level in a way that we really have not seen before. Because here in Washington, this town crawls with very well-paid lobbyists, who are here to represent special corporate interests, very powerful people, the drug companies, the oil companies, multinational corporations, and to counterbalance that incredible power, we need just a very, very strong grassroots movement.
How do people like you and Russ Feingold and Barbara Boxer, presumably Jim Webb is going to find himself in that camp from the way he's talking, perhaps John Tester,
Sherrod Brown of Ohio.
Sherrod Brown, yeah. How do you progressives who are not towing the corporate line survive politically when every 6 years you have to run a campaign that costs a bloody fortune?
Well, the answer to that for me, I can't speak to the others, is pretty simple. We ran a campaign against one of the wealthiest people in the state of Vermont, a guy who had an unlimited sum of money to spend in a small state. And we were able to raise the kinds of money that we raised, and we ended up raising a lot more than I ever dreamed we could raise. We raised well over $5 million. We did it because we had 8,000 people in the state of Vermont. We're a small state, 630,000 people. 8,000 people contributed to our campaign. Sometimes it was a $5 bill and sometimes a $20 bill. And then we had tens and tens of thousands of people who I think came from every state in America. So the way we did it, in a sense, was the old-fashioned way. My opponent was able to write out a check for, $6 million for himself. That's fine. We had to do it gaining tens and tens of thousands of small individual contributions.
It seems to me that, and I know this is near and dear to your heart, that some sort of reform, public financing of campaigns, some kind of reform, getting corporations out of the business of lobbying has to happen.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we need to do, and I've said this many, many times, is move toward public financing of elections. Now, our opponents say, well, this is corporate welfare for politicians. Why should taxpayers and government help provide funding for candidates? And the answer is that the alternative is, who do you think is going to pay for the campaigns when they cost $10 million or $20 million? By and large, they are going to be wealthy individuals. They're going to be large corporations. And these guys don't make contributions because of their great sense of civics and respect for American democracy. They're doing it clearly to gain benefits for themselves and the special interests that they represent. And the end result of that is that you have a government, and you certainly have had this for the last 6 years under Bush, in which piece of legislation after piece of legislation is written by powerful special interests and voted upon and supported by powerful special interests. And that is not a reasonable alternative. So I think we need to move to public financing of elections, and that's an area that we'll be working hard on.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's working really well here in Portland, Oregon. And I've read the stuff about what happened in Maine, and it's working well there and
that's
in Arizona.
Right.
But here it was just spectacular. This last election, Eric Sten, the city councilor, took the public financing, $100,000. If you can get 1,000 people to give you $5, you get $100,000. He was opposed by a woman who was being funded by Enron, and they gave her $125,000, so the city gave Eric another $25,000, and it was all public. It was all transparent. It was all in the newspapers.
That is exactly what I think, Tom, the direction that we have to go in this election.
Yeah. And it worked very well, and he ended up winning the election because everybody figured out who was representing whom. Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our number, 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com. We'll be back with your calls for Bernie Sanders right after this. Stick around.
Nobody told me that you'd be like me. Nobody told me that you'd be like me. Nobody told me.
This must be George W. Bush's song. And welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, The Democracy Zone, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont. And our telephone number, 866-440-8466. And Don in Murfreesboro, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our very first and favorite affiliates. Hey, Don.
Yes, good morning, Tom. I would like to ask the senator a question I asked you 2-3 weeks ago concerning Social Security. Does he ever think that they will make it mandatory for everybody? I've written letters to my two senators, and I get really excuses back. And my question is, if not, why not?
I think that there is a... I'm not familiar with all of the details. I am familiar with some of them. And I think there is a movement toward that, which is one of the tools that we'll need to make sure that Social Security is solvent and strong for our kids and our grandchildren. But in terms of Social Security, the most important thing that we can do right now is, A, understand that Social Security, despite what the president is saying, is not going bankrupt. With modest changes such as lifting the cap, Social Security will be there for the next 75 years, which is as long as the actuaries think we need to figure it out at this point. So we are going to be working on Social Security. The good news about this election, one of the immediate results, is any effort to privatize Social Security will be dead. What I hope the Democratic leadership will do is give us tools to make sure that we strengthen Social Security so it's there for the indefinite future.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, and that last bumper music was John Lennon. Today, the anniversary of John Lennon's death.
That was a terrible, terrible loss.
Yeah,
I just recently saw a film on him, and what a remarkable guy he was in every sense of the word.
Yeah, I've heard about that film. Yeah, I've got to go see it. John in Los Angeles, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator. First question is, I want to know if you're going to be running for president in 2008.
No, but I'm going to have to do with it. I'll be one of the two senators not running for president. There you go.
The reason I called was I hear the Democrats always talking about raising minimum wage, and you know, that's great. I mean, I know we need that, but what are they going to do for the middle class? Middle class does not make minimum wage. And, for example, my wife has... in her job, they lost their benefits. They were able to get a pay raise, and then more work was put on her, and she's actually taking a pay cut now. And, you know, what are they going to do for the middle class?
Well, that is a very good point. Raising the minimum wage is absolutely imperative because nobody in America should work for $5.15 an hour. But you're right, the vast majority of the people make a heck of a lot more than that. What we need to do for the middle class is move toward a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. That will be huge for low-income people, for the middle class, for everybody in our country. It'll be important for the economy because we will take the burden of health care off the backs of small businesses and, in fact, large businesses. The other thing that we've got to do for the middle class, which is huge, is that at a time when college costs are soaring, we not only have to rescind Bush's cutbacks in financial aid, which results in higher interest rates for middle-class families, we've got to go a lot further than that. And that means not only lowering loans for middle-class college families, we have to significantly expand the Pell Grant program. And that is a grant. Those are scholarships. Right now, those funds are, in terms of real dollars, significantly less than where they used to be, and I will be strongly supporting a major expansion of Pell Grants so that the middle class, will get the kind of help that it needs to send its kids to college. Those are just a few of the areas that we've got to move on.
You mentioned health care. Just here's a heads up. This is from USA Today, Bernie, from yesterday. Cigna, you know, the insurance
yep.
company Cigna, they are raising the rate on one of their plans for medium-sized businesses. This one in particular is hitting the Screen Actors Guild to $44,220 a year for a family of four. $44,220 a year.
Which is a lot more money than the average family in the state of Vermont earns.
I know. It's incredible.
You don't have a roof over your head, I guess you'll be just fine.
Yeah. they point out nationwide the average is $11,480. But this,
yeah, well, I don't know what kind of
this is
particular insurance policy the Screen Actors Guild has. But
yeah.
the point is that health care in America, our system is disintegrating, costs are soaring, more and more people are uninsured and underinsured, and we spend twice as much per person than does any other country. There's enormous waste, profiteering, bureaucracy within our system. We've got to simplify the system. The goal of healthcare expenditure is not to make insurance companies or drug companies wealthy. It is to provide quality healthcare to all of our people. It is a huge issue. The opposition here in Washington toward a national healthcare program is enormous because obviously companies are making billions and billions of dollars off of the inefficiencies in healthcare. It's a lot of work, but that is the goal that we have got to achieve.
Yeah, but right now we have a system where William McGuire makes a $2 billion annual paycheck. I mean, it's just bizarre.
That is.
It is bizarre. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Congressman, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders is with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. This the anniversary of in 1980, however many years that is. What is that? 26 years? 26 years, yeah, since John Lennon was killed in a tragedy. Congressman Bernie Sanders had to go take a vote during the break at the bottom of the hour. I understand he will be back within 5 minutes. So we will be back with Bernie in a few minutes, but I'll hop in here and take your calls for a few minutes, and we'll see. Actually, I noticed KJ and Camus Washington have been on the board before Bernie even came on. So, hey, KJ, welcome to the program.
Well, I'd hope to ask Bernie a couple of questions. Maybe you can pass them on.
Okay. We can try our best.
All right. You've mentioned over the last few weeks how our economy is being held together by spit and bailing wire. And I imagine the progressives should anticipate that the Republicans and the neocons or whoever are probably going to pull the rug out from under us once these people take power. I wondered if they had a plan in place, possibly to protect average folks like you and me from the fallout. And the other question I had was, they've got this great agenda, but you know Bush is going to veto every single bill that they put before him, and I don't know that they have enough votes to override a veto. So
yeah, well, as far as whether or not the Democrats have a plan to deal with an economic collapse or disaster, or, you know, whatever, I can't speak to that. We can ask Bernie, although Bernie's not a Democrat, although he does caucus with them, but he's not a spokesman for the Democratic Party or for the Democrats. With regard to, again, your second question was.
Bush will probably veto.
Oh, the veto. That's right. Yeah. I was noticing the chat room here got distracted. With regard to Bush vetoing things, this is what Bernie was talking about when he first came on in the very beginning of this, was that yes, there is a majority of Democrats and Democratic leaning folks who are in control of the Senate, but it's a one vote majority. And that one vote could be Joe Lieberman. I mean, you know, Bernie's not saying that, but I'll say that. And that's that. And it takes more than a majority to pass Well, you can pass legislation with a majority, but because the Senate has this rule about cloture, about cutting off debate, it's called filibustering, stopping a filibuster, it requires 60 votes. It requires, 60% of the Senate. And so really what we need to be doing is reaching out to and lobbying to not just the conservative Democrats, because there are some there, and those Democrats who, and Joe Lieberman as well, the independent who portray themselves as Democrats and say, hey, please get with the progressive program here. There's, America really is in the progressive camp and would like to see this country become more progressive. But also reaching out to the Republicans who might be amenable to taking some of these positions. The Olympia Snow, Susan Collins. I don't know if George Voinovich got reelected or not, or if he's still, I believe he's still the senator from Ohio, the other senator from Ohio, along with Sherrod Brown now. But reaching out and just right across the board, lobbying, even if you have a Republican senator. I mean, I have Gordon Smith here in Oregon as my senator, and he came out yesterday ranting about how he's opposed to the war, but that's certainly not how he's been voting and how he's been talking for years and years. And he's starting to have to react and respond to the concerns of his constituents. And, in a way, I look at that and I, kind of cynically, oh, yeah, okay, here's a politician who's changing his tune because that's, the way the public is going. But on the other hand, that's really what we want. We want politicians. It's the same thing with Schwarzenegger. Oh, gee, he's becoming more progressive or more liberal because the people are saying, no, we don't like the conservative crazy stuff that you're trying to inflict on us, like busting unions. Well, actually, that's what you want your politicians to do, is when they hear from the people that they don't like the way you're going, you change course. And it's not a failure of leadership or a failure of will. I think it's listening to the people. So, KJ, I think the answer is that we have to be holding our politicians accountable, that it didn't stop with the election. Makes sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I might also be interesting to point out, good to point out that now that the Republicans are no longer in the majority, is it possible we have a lot of moderate Republicans now that are going to more inclined to vote their conscience rather than toe the party line?
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. And hopefully they're going to get it as well. Thanks a lot for the call, KJ. Warren in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, Warren, what's up? Oh, I'm sorry. This is Greg in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing this morning?
Hey, I'm fine. How are you, Greg?
I'm doing great. I wish we had an entire Congress of Bernie Sanders in there. Whether they agree or disagree with me, the integrity of him is just so high.
I agree. There's a few Republicans, like Ron Paul in Texas, who will always tell you honestly what he thinks, even though you may totally disagree with him. And tragically, we don't have more. You're right.
Well, what I called for, and I hope I misread this story, I saw a wire story in our local paper for the Grand Rapids Press, that the Bush administration is now pressuring the EPA to change the lead standards to lower them?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that is the fact, and yeah.
Now, can Congress stop that, or is that an executive order kind of thing?
That's a good question. I believe that this is just the administration. Here's the story from the Associated Press. The Bush administration is considering doing away with health standards that cut lead from gasoline, widely regarded as one of the nation's biggest clear air accomplishments. Battery makers, lead smelters, refineries all have lobbied the administration to do away with the Clean Air Act limits. A preliminary staff review released by the EPA this week acknowledged the possibility of dropping the health standards for lead air pollution. The agency says revoking those standards might be justified given the significantly changed circumstances since lead was listed in 1976 as an air pollutant. And they say that the reason that they would be justified is because lead in the air has dropped more than 90%. Well, it's dropped 90% because we banned it!
The man is out of his mind. I'm sorry. He really is.
Yeah, well, Henry Waxman called him on it. I mean, he came to the floor of the House, and he said that he is calling on the agency to renounce this dangerous proposal immediately because lead, a highly toxic element, can cause severe nerve damage, especially in children. He wrote to the EPA administrator, Stephen Johnson, and said this deregulatory effort cannot be defended.
Well, and up here in Grand Rapids, they have a huge program. It's called Get the Lead Out, and it's about rebuilding the older houses in the inner city areas and redoing the windows and covering up the paints and everything because these young children are so vulnerable to it.
Sure, Yeah.
So, well, thank you for your time.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear, from you. 1-866-440-8466. Robin in Woodland, Washington. Hey, Robin. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was hoping to bend Bernie's ear a little bit. This current administration that we have seems to just appoint criminal after criminal after criminal to posts within the government. I mean, you know, they're mostly all felons from back in the Iran-Contra days.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I would like to plant a bug in Bernie's ear about is to maybe enact legislation that no one convicted of a felony can ever be appointed to you know, some of these higher offices, so that we can keep the criminals out of the government, whether they were pardoned or not.
Yeah, sounds like a reasonable idea.
Yeah, one of the things
that Nancy Pelosi is talking about doing is having, and Harry Reid, they're both talking about having a 5-day work week in the Senate. So, and one of the things that would do is eliminate the possibility of the president having these recess appointments where he can get around the will of the Senate.
Yeah,
Bernie's back with us.
Brilliant idea.
Bernie, Robin in Woodland, Washington was just bringing up the question of, is it possible to stop having the Bush administration appoint all these felons to high levels, high positions in government?
I think you're going to see a lot. Absolutely, yes. The answer, to the best of my knowledge, not being an expert on Senate rules at this point, is I think we're going to do a lot better. Not only in stopping that, but in stopping some of these right-wing judges who really are not qualified to hold.
And a previous caller had asked, there is talk that the Republicans are planning on dropping a series of economic bombs on the Democrats as soon as they take office in January, you know, rejiggering the numbers, the economic numbers, things like that. Do the Democrats have any kind of a plan for what happens if the economy
doesn't
tank?
No question. The Republicans understand that they have done a disastrous job, that the American people know that they've done a disastrous job, and that this last 2 years in Congress has been one of the most ineffectual and do-nothing Congresses in American history. So clearly what they want to do is to stop the Democrats from moving forward in a bold, aggressive way to protect the middle class, to protect our environment, to protect our, to move toward health care reform and so forth and so on. So they will be doing everything they can to put sand into the gears to slow things up. Everybody's expecting that.
Yeah. Dave in Los Angeles, California. We just have a minute before we have to take a break. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dave.
I wanted to ask Bernie if the Democratic Congress can do anything to stop this AT&T merger and what's going on with the FCC right now with the gentleman unrecruising himself to vote in favor of this and the net neutrality issue that this all centers.
What I can tell you is that there is more consciousness now in Congress about media in general, both from a public policy point of view and from a political point of view, than there has ever been. I mean, this is an issue I have been working on for many years. Tom Hartman has talked about it for many years. The issue is, in a nation which is politically divided, where the Democrats seem to have the edge now, why do you have such a right-wing dominance in radio, for example? What are we going to do about media mergers so that the American people can hear, in fact, different points of view? We can have diverse ownership. Huge issue.
Yeah, and even on TV, I mean, you got Glenn Beck now on the news network. It's totally weird, but don't get me started. Bernie Sanders. Bernie is back from his vote. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be back with your calls right after this break. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program.
Oh, this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone.
And welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us. Warren in Eugene, Oregon, you're live with Bernie.
Hi. Thanks, guys. A couple of years back, Administrator Paul Bremer said that the unemployment rate in Iraq was about 50%. English-speaking Al Jazeera put it at 70%. And I think both of you guys are old enough to remember what this country was like when we were at 12 or 13%. And so I'm thinking, do you think that the country's conflicts and problems will greatly diminish if we put those folks back to work rather than our companies?
Absolutely. I mean, clearly one of the sources of resentment and anger and frustration of many in a country which is falling apart, the country of Iraq, is the fact that unemployment is incredibly high. Basic services like electricity, access to gasoline for people's cars is worse than it used to be. So to the degree that we can rebuild their infrastructure, to the degree that we can put people to work, clearly people will feel a lot better and less sympathetic to violence.
Yeah, during the Marshall Plan, we gave money to German companies to rebuild Germany, and that rebuilt German industry at the same time.
And
why are we giving money to Bechtel and
Oliver? I think, Tom, that is one of the areas you're going to begin to see oversight, you're going to begin to see hearings on the whole reconstruction of Iraq, Halliburton, the profiteering, the fact that we are not providing the kinds of quality assistance and timely assistance for the people of Iraq so that they can not only rebuild their economy but create good-paying jobs for their own people is something that I'm sure will be studied.
Okay. Rama in Williamstown, Vermont. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hey, Bernie. Quick statement and explanation how it applies to you and then my question. And the statement is I'm very, very concerned about this Iraqi war morphing into an Iranian war. How it applies to you in a very direct sense is my understanding is you voted for something that was, I don't know, the Iranian Freedom Act or some or something along that lines, which is it's a law that more or less is another rhetorical device which is used by administrations to justify getting tough with the nation. And my question is, can you provide me any direct evidence of a real and existing threat that Iran presents to the United States? And how are you planning on handling the issues of war and peace in the Senate?
Well, first of all, the so-called Iranian Freedom Act had very, very specific language in it, making it clear that this was not any kind of authorization for military action against Iran. And I think there's some misunderstanding about that, but that is, in fact, the reality. Clearly, I will do everything that I can, as someone who voted and helped lead the opposition to the war in Iraq, to prevent a war with Iran. That is about the last thing in the world that we need. I would hope now with change in the House and the Senate, we'll be looking at new approaches in foreign policy, approaches which require and call for international cooperation and bringing nations together, rather than providing arms and weaponry to countries as we're currently doing. So we'll be active in that area.
Well said. Prez in San Francisco, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Listen, I have a quick comment about Social Security. You know, supposedly back in a few years ago, they raised the amount deducted to take care of the baby boomers, and we've forgotten about that. Apparently that's been tried to be pushed out of the consciousness of people to allow for the increasing numbers.
That's right.
But also, I wanted to comment on something. Somebody else talked about the media reform. And I've been working on a campaign finance reform for a while. And I would think that the most important thing we have in this country right now with unions and our vote is about all we got left. And I think that the media reform and the FCC reform to allow these people to actually be held to the standards they say they're going to be held to when it comes up for licensing every year, they actually put some teeth into those rules and actually make them provide free time, air time, like they're doing in a lot of other countries for political debates. So that'll get rid of a lot of the money involved and paying for that advertising time. And that'll help us get back campaign finance reform, and the only argument that they have going against it right now is very popular is the corporate welfare, their politicians' welfare they're talking about, and that will eliminate that problem, I believe.
Well, I think your point is a very good point. The airwaves belong to the people. We have given these airwaves over to large multinational media conglomerates who are making zillions of dollars in profits, and the demand that they provide for the public good, which was built into the original legislation, has been essentially negated over the years, and pretty much they can do whatever they can to make as much money as possible
rather than trying to provide for the public good. So I think you're exactly right, and that is an area we're going to have to take a very hard look at.
Just a couple of quick questions here. I know we only have about 20 seconds, Bernie. How do we restore the power of the legislative branch, and what can be done to help the middle class?
Well, I would hope that what you will see a radical change in is the United States Congress beginning to understand that they are not a rubber stamp for the White House. They are an equal branch of government. They have the right to hold the White House accountable, and that they will hopefully begin to stand up for the middle class and working families of this country who have been ignored for so many years.
So we're all going to be pushing for that one.
Okay.
Amen. Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us
today. Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great having you on. It's 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up in the rest of the program, coming up after the news at the top of the hour, the guy who started the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, Jerome Corsi, he's out talking about Iran. And in the third hour of our program, we're going to be talking about how political communication happens. How do you crack the code on political communication? We're going to be essentially putting together a book on the air. I think you'll find it fascinating. We'll be back. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Okay, so what's going on with Iran? What's going on with Iraq? What's going on with Saudi Arabia? Is this all about oil? Is this all about power? Is it all about Israel? What's going on in the Middle East? The Iraq Study Group talking about privatizing the oil supply in Iraq. Is that what it's all about? Why is Jim Baker involved in this thing when his law firm is representing the Saudi Arabian government against the victims of 9/11? A lot of interesting questions here. Jerome Corsi with us. He is the co-author of Showdown with Nuclear Iran. His website, Help Stop Iran Now, probably best known to our listeners as the guy behind the Swift Boat Veterans character assassination of John Kerry. Jerry Corsi, welcome to the program.
Tom, great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks for coming back on with us. First of all, let's just start at the beginning. What's your take on the, you know, I threw a bunch of questions out there at the beginning. You've got this HelpStopIranNow.com. Help stop Iran what?
Well, the barrage of questions, I think, cutting it through it, Tom, the best way to summarize it is I think I see Iran as the problem here, because Iran has been causing a lot of the insurgency within Iraq. Iran, I think, basically would like to think we won their 8-year war that they had in the 1980s between Iran and Iraq. I think Iran would like to think we've now won that war for them, and they'd like to collect on Iraq. And what I'm saying is that to bring Iran...
And we were fighting on the side of Iraq in that war. I mean, we were supporting Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran.
Well, we did, and we also supported Iran at the same time.
Oh, you're right. We were providing them with intelligence.
Well, and also with the Iran-Contra, we were trying to get Iran to release hostages that Hezbollah had taken in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And now, so what? We were supporting both sides of that war.
You know, I'm a little confused about your positions on this, because on the one hand, I mean, you're the co-author of this book, Showdown with Nuclear Iran. You've got this website, Help Stop Iran Now. But some of the positions that you've been quoted on in 2002 and in 2004, you've said, let's see, exactly why isn't it the case that Islam is a worthless, dangerous, satanic religion? Where's the proof to the contrary?
Well,
that...
Tom, you're quoting something that I've disavowed, and that's totally out of context. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be fair, you'd read the whole things I've said about that and not quote that. I've also written, why don't you quote what I wrote, Atomic Iran, and that is that Islam is a fully legitimate religion. I walked 200 miles with the Iranian expatriates from the Liberty Bell all the way to Washington, D.C.
So you're disavowing the times that you used phrases like, you said, ragheads are boy bumpers as clearly as they are woman haters?
None of those phrases, and none of that was written to be what I believe. Those were all extreme statements written to be extreme statements. That was the purpose of writing them at that time. How extreme can we say these things? Okay, here's some examples. Now, to say that that's what I believe just isn't correct, and I don't accept it. I've apologized for those statements, because I think even to use them as an exercise was wrong, but you can't say that I believe them because I don't.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you clarified that. Thank you. Back to Iran for a moment. It seems to me that what's going on here is that Saudi Arabia has been exporting Wahhabism, a virulent form of Sunni Islam. I mean, if we wanted to make analogies in the Christian community, we could say that Wahhabism is that the Sunni, let's say that the Sunnis are like the Protestants and the Shia are like the Catholics, and the Wahhabists within the Sunnis would be like, you know, the right wing hyper, you know, the Tim McVeighs of Protestantism. I mean, Tim McVeigh was, you know, a white power hyper Christian, thought that he was going to create a Christian nation, kill all the Catholics, you know, in addition to everybody else. And on the Shia side, you've got, you know, let's say that they're sort of like the Catholics. You've got the you know, Opus Dei on steroids. You know, you've got Sadr and this bunch, and Iran. Iran is supporting the Shiites. Saudi Arabia is supporting the Sunnis, and we're seeing all these reports in the media right now that Saudi Arabia is, not officially, but through their very, very wealthy families connected to the royal family, funding the Sunni insurgency. It's the Sunnis who are doing many of the murderous attacks against the Shias, and, you know, first bombed the Shia mosque, and then the Shias are saying, okay, now we're reprising. I mean, aren't we seeing really here a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran for control of Iraq?
Well, first, I agree with you, Tom, that you can see radicals hijack any religion, and you pointed to a bunch that have. Now, I think, you know, what I'm saying is, rather than getting whether this is a proxy war or not, I think throughout the region, what we need to do is be supporting the moderate forces in all these countries, which do exist.
But we're not doing that. I mean, the Iraq Study Group report does not even once address Saudi Arabia. It talks about we need to talk to and engage Iran and Syria, but it also sort of casts some blame their way. And this administration will not discuss Saudi Arabia at all. Dick Cheney's, you know, summoned by the Saudis to go over there, and yet Saudi Arabia is pumping cash and weapons into this conflict.
Well, Tom, I think this Iran Study Group recommendations are pretty much worthless. And I don't agree with the Bush administration policy on either Iraq, Iran, or Saudi Arabia. What I'm saying is, what we said in Showdown with Nuclear Iran is that we've got to support the moderate forces. This is a third alternative. It's not in Iraq or Iran that we either have to go to war or do nothing. There is a third alternative. The third alternative is that we support the moderate forces of Islam that want freedom in their own countries around the world. This Ahmadinejad regime is not solid. I mean, right now we have...
Well, it's not even a regime. I mean, he's more of a figurehead.
He's got solid support in the Ayatollahs. Ayatollah Yazdi supports him very strongly. He's got religious support. But also the students just this week were out again in the streets opposing Ahmadinejad's regime. Even the assembly has voted to hold an election a year early because Ahmadinejad is so unpopular in Iran. We make a mistake to think that these are solid governments.
Right, my point, and if we were to follow many of your fellow travelers, you know, many of the right-wing cons and neocons who...
Well, Tom,
I
object to that because you haven't read what I've said. You're trying to lump me in with a bunch of other people, and you're...
I understand. Let me finish my sentence, and maybe it'll make more sense. If we were to follow the path of the people that you were aggressively supporting in the 2004 election when you went after John Kerry with the whole Swift Boat Veterans thing, if we were to follow their path, we would be having war with Iran, and which would further empower Ahmadinejad. Well, and it sounds to me like you're disavowing yourself from the people that you've been most closely associated to.
Well, Tom, first of all, you assume that the unfit for command was a character assassination against John Kerry.
Yes, I do. I read it. You and I discussed it on the air at the time.
I object to that, and I continue to object to that. Secondly, if it was, let him sue us. If anything we wrote there was...
He's a public figure.
Well, he can't.
I mean, yeah, it's easy to say that. In England, he could do that, but he can't in the United States.
There's a lawsuit going on against Stolen Honor, the movie. He can sue the book if he wants to as well. I'm saying, Tom, that book also was not written, and I didn't write it to support George Bush. The Bush, that's separate, is written against John Kerry. It's a different thing.
But it was funded by, you know, Perry and these other guys out of Texas. The whole campaign was funded to bring down John Kerry so that George Bush would become president.
Well, no, it was funded to oppose John Kerry. I'll agree with that. You did not have agreement among the Swift Boat vets to go against George Bush. It just isn't true, no matter how many times you say it, Tom. It isn't true.
So you're saying, Jerry Casey, that you're not part of that you wouldn't characterize yourself as a right-winger.
Well, I'm not going to characterize myself as a right-winger.
Or a conservative.
I'm a conservative, and I'm not a right-winger. And, so, Tom, that's just a characterization. You have not read what I have written. I've written very critically against George Bush, including on the war in Iraq. What I've been saying I didn't walk 200 miles with expatriate Iranians because I want a war. I don't want a war. And to characterize me as neocons wanting a war is just wrong. You haven't read what I've written.
The point I was making is that the people that you were hanging out with want a war, and I wonder how you're going to stop them.
Well, I'm saying that we do not need to have a war. I'm saying that there's a whole other course of action. We passed the Iran Freedom Support Act. It's got millions of dollars in it sitting in the Department of State to support these non-governmental organizations around the world that want to bring freedom to their own country.
In other words, let's do it like the way that in part we brought down the Soviet Union with things like Radio Free America, Radio Free, et cetera, influencing.
Ukraine, we had a very peaceful revolution. We also had apartheid stopped in South Africa. We didn't have to have a war there either.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways, Tom, to approach these issues, and to say either we've got to do nothing or have a war is just limited thinking, and that's the kind of frame that the Iran study group wanted to put on the issue.
Yeah.
It's, James Baker has been, I've been opposed to James Baker for years on this. He did the same thing in Oslo. He said we needed to give back land to the Palestinians, and that would get peace for the Jews in Israel. Well, it hasn't, because the Palestinians are not agreed to Israel's survival. We need to support the moderates, even the Palestinian Authority, that want to be responsible. Then maybe you can give back land and get peace.
Interesting. Jerry Corsi, it's interesting to dig deeper and deeper into what you're all about and what you're doing. Thanks for coming on the program. HelpStopIranNow.com, the website. Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks, Tom. Anytime.
16 minutes past the hour. Yes, indeed. John Lennon, 26 years ago today, assassinated. The day the music died. Another day the music died. The other one was the Big Bopper. And anyhow, Sacred Grounds, welcome back to our program. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Support the sponsors that you hear on our local stations. Please let them know you're listening. And our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532, their phone number, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, at smalldog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ecowine.com, their website. All three, by the way, great sources for Christmas, Hanukkah, Happy Yule, Kwanzaa, whatever your holiday may be for holiday gifts. There were some truly radical proposals coming out of this Iraq study group, and they are getting almost no attention in the press. I try to bring these up in this conversation with Jerome Corsi, and it didn't stick. So I'm just going to nail this stuff down here. A year ago, George Bush hired a fellow away from the U.S. consulting company. It's called Bering Point Incorporated, about a year ago, to be an advisor to the Iraqi oil ministry on how they should pass some kind of a new national oil law. Antonio Juhas writes about this, by the way, over at Alternet, in a piece called Oil for Sale, Iraq Study Group Recommends Privatization. That suggestion that the Bush administration helped work out with the oil ministry was not complete privatization, but something closer to the model that you have, for example, in Alaska, where the oil is considered an asset under the ground, is considered an asset of the people in the state, at least that oil that's on state-owned lands. And when it gets pumped out by the private companies, they pay the state a royalty. They pay the state a fee for it. So it's sort of partly private, partly public. Before, the entire oil, you know, the pumping, the shipping, the selling, everything was owned by the Iraqi oil company. It was nationalized. Everything accrued to the benefit of the government, which was largely Saddam Hussein, although it also supported the economy of Iraq. It's like Chavez is doing in Venezuela to a large extent. But the ISG, the Iraq Study Group, has some really startling language in it. They say, and I'm quoting from the Iraq Study Group report, the United States should assist Iraqi leaders to reorganize the national oil industry of Iraq as a commercial enterprise. End quote. Now this is privatizing the oil industry of Iraq. Now, a lot of people, I think, if they heard that, they'd say, you know, wait a minute, privatizing the oil industry of Iraq? Who would suggest that and why? Well, let's consider the fact that leading this thing was James Baker III. And along with him was Lawrence Eagleburger. Both of these guys worked with Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and the 1990s, particularly on behalf of the oil companies and their relationship with Saddam Hussein. As Antonio Juhas writes over at Alternet, on April 21st, 1990, a U.S. delegation, this is before the first Iraq war, was sent to Iraq to placate Saddam Hussein as his anti-American rhetoric and threats of a Kuwait invasion intensified. James A. Baker III, then President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, personally sent a cable to the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad instructing the U.S. ambassador to meet with Hussein and to make clear that, quote, as concerned as we are about Iraq's chemical nuclear missile programs, we are not in any sense preparing the way for preemptive military unilateral efforts to eliminate these programs. End of quote. That's James Baker's cable to the U.S. ambassador in Iraq. Instead, he said, our interest, our relationship with Iraq is focused on trade. He said this is, quote, the central factor in the U.S.-Iraq relationship, end quote. In 1982, Reagan had removed Iraq from the list of countries supporting terrorism. And from 82 when he did that until 1990, that eight-year period, Iraq and American trade boomed up to the point where it was over $5.2 billion a year. We were buying $5.2 billion worth of $5.5 billion worth of Iraqi oil and selling to them $5.2 billion worth of stuff. From military hardware, this is just in 1989, for example, from military hardware to consumer goods. We were buying 1.1 million barrels a day of oil from Iraq from 87 to 1990. And who put this together? Baker and Eagleburger. In December of 1983, then Undersecretary of State Eagleburger wrote the U.S. Export-Import Bank to personally urge it to begin extending loans to Iraq to, quote, signal our belief in the future viability of the Iraqi company and secure a U.S. foothold in a potentially large export market, end quote. He noted that Iraq, quote, has plans well advanced for an additional 50% increase in its oil exports by the end of 1984, end quote. In 84, when Baker became Treasury Secretary, Reagan opens full diplomatic relations with Iraq, and Eagleburger becomes president of Henry Kissinger's company, Kissinger Associates, and they start working with Iraq. They created this thing called the Forum that included Bechtel, Lockheed, Texaco, ExxonMobil, and Hunt Oil. 27 minutes past the hour.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions and my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to express my inner feelings and thankfulness for showing me the meaning of success.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. The New York Times headline, right up at the top of their website, I don't have the printed newspaper here, but you look at nytimes.com, dueling views pit Baker against Rice, Many of the critiques in the Iraq Study Group's report boil down to the differing views of a former Secretary of State and the current one. It's the battle that is going on here, the duel that is going on, as it were, is between, oddly enough, is between the criminals of the first Reagan-Bush administration. It really should have been called the Bush-Reagan administration, because George Herbert Walker Bush, although he was vice president, Reagan was full-blown into Alzheimer's even before he was elected to his second term, and way over the edge the last 3 years of his second term. I mean, he just wasn't there. George Herbert Walker Bush was running the White House along with Nancy Reagan and Jim Baker and, you know, et cetera. And so it's the criminals from that administration versus the criminals from the current administration. It's the old war criminals, the guys who were supporting Saddam on the one hand and Iran on the other, the guys who were supporting Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union back in the 80s, versus Condi Rice and George W. Bush, who think that they can, you know, if they kill enough people, they can solve all these problems. It's interesting. Yesterday, a friend of mine, Louis Malmadrona, he's a physician, a psychiatrist. He used to teach down at the University of Arizona and their integrative medicine program with Andrew Weil. He's the author of a number of books, Coyote Medicine, Coyote Healing. He's a Native American. He now is up in Saskatchewan as a professor of medicine and also a practicing physician. And he spent the night at our house last night. And we were talking about, you know, the American worldview and how the Canadians see it, and it was a fascinating conversation. And he said, you know, the American strategy to pretty much everything can be summarized in two words: kill it. He said, in medicine, we look at, you know, cancer. How do you do it? You kill it. Infection, kill it. There's, you know, crime. How do you solve crime? You kill it. You kill people. George W. Bush's solution to crime in Texas was to execute 134 people, the most of any governor in the history of the United States. Gleefully, never spent more than 20 minutes evaluating an execution order, and was proud of that fact. His idea, his solution to the problem in Iraq: if you kill enough of them, you'll solve the problem. I mean, there is this weird mentality. Lewis was suggesting it's uniquely American. I would say no. I'd say that it probably tracks back. It's deep in the roots of European history. This notion that, well, if you just kill enough of them, you can solve all the problems. So anyhow, it's the old, you know, kill one group of them bunch from the first Bush-Reagan administration to now the current Bush administration, a new kill a bunch of them folks. And as I was pointing out, you know, Lawrence Eagleburger and James Baker on this commission, in 1984, Baker was the Treasury Secretary, and what did he do? He opens full diplomatic relations with Iraq. At the same time, Eagleburger becomes president of Henry Kissinger's company, Kissinger Associates, and they participated in this thing called the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, through their managing director, Alan Stoga. That forum was a trade association representing some, this, again, from Antonia's article in Alternet. That forum was a trade association representing some 60 American companies, including Bechtel, Lockheed, Texaco, ExxonMobil, and Hunt Oil. The Iraqi ambassador to the United States, Saddam Hussein's guy, in 1985 said to an audience in Washington, D.C., quote, "Our people in Baghdad will give priority, when there is a competition between two companies, to the company that is a member of the forum." This is that group that Kissinger Associates participated in through their managing director, Alan Stoga, Kissinger Associates, whose president was Lawrence Eagleburger, who is now on the Iraq Study Group. Many Kissinger clients were also members of the forum and became recipients of contracts with Saddam Hussein. Then in 1989, Eagleburger went back to the State Department, now working for Jim Baker again. This is the same year that President Bush the Elder signed National Security Directive number 26. What did that say? We should pursue and seek to facilitate opportunities for U.S. firms to participate in the reconstruction of the Iraqi economy, particularly in the energy area. Bush Sr. then began discussions about a $1 billion loan guarantee for Iraq 1 week before Secretary of State Jim Baker meets with Tariq Aziz at the State Department to seal the deal. Jim Baker, whose family law firm, Baker Botts, which has been around since 1914, his dad's business, his grandfather's business, the family law firm represents Texaco, Exxon, Halliburton, ConocoPhillips, or has represented in the past, and is currently representing the government of Saudi Arabia against the victims of 9/11 who are suing the Saudis. Eagleburger was on the board of directors of Halliburton. Is all this starting to make sense that the Iraq study group would come back and say, well, you know, our main priority here should be to kind of keep the situation stable so that we can privatize the oil in Iraq? And who's the 700-pound gorilla in the room? It's Saudi Arabia, who are funding the Sunni insurgents against Iran, who are funding the Shia insurgents. Here we have a proxy war going on, and we are right smack dab in the middle of it. We are finding ourselves in the position that Cambodia would have found themselves in if they tried to stabilize Vietnam while the North Vietnamese being funded by the Soviets and the South Vietnamese being funded by us were fighting each other. It's an imperfect metaphor because Vietnam didn't have any oil. But I think it stands. So something to consider. In fact, Lawrence Eagleburger, he was asked, this from Dana Milbank, this is the Washington Post. Minutes after the Iraq study group placed an improvised explosive device beneath the Bush administration's Iraq policy yesterday, panel member Lawrence Eagleburger was asked how President Bush reacted to the recommendations. This is a verbatim quote. His reaction was, "Where's my drink?" Really? Eagleburger continued, he was a little loaded. It was early in the morning, too, you know? What? So then Dana Milbank says, the retired diplomat certainly did not mean that the president had fallen off the wagon. How do you know? Anyhow, this whole thing, and now Bush is saying, well, you know, we're not even going to pay attention to it. It's like the competent trying to offer suggestions to the incompetent about how to do something that's essentially criminal and should never have been done in the first place. But at least if you're going to do it competently. End of rant. 43 minutes past the hour, 866-440-8466. John Lennon's the anniversary of his death today. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie.
Hi. I did see that movie, The U.S. versus John Lennon, and I really recommend it. The thing that really struck me was Yoko and John, I think it was in the early 70s, put huge billboards in several major cities saying, war is over, in huge letters, if you want it. Mm-hmm. And their idea was that instead of continuing violence and dwelling on war, that if everyone latched onto the concept and just said, war is over, it would be so. And I thought that was just outrageously great.
Yeah, it's an absolutely solid idea. Let's make the idea of war as toxic as the idea of child abuse or the idea of drunken driving. I mean, there are things that, you know, in our society for a long, long time, we tolerated child abuse. You know, spare the rod and spoil the child, blah, blah, blah. You know, beating up kids was considered a normal and acceptable thing. Getting drunk and driving was considered normal and acceptable. People would go in the 1950s to cocktail parties after work, happy hour. All this happy hour preceded driving home, right? It's no longer acceptable. Let's make war socially unacceptable. John Lennon was spot on.
In the interview, he said nobody even considers that thought.
Yeah. Good point, Jackie. Thank you for sharing that and calling and raising. Right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, who is the cultural icon assassinated on this day in 1980? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed. My answer coming up after the break.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep it dope with religion, sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day, who was the cultural icon assassinated on this day in 1980? Congratulations to Richard Jacques of Orangevale, California. Or Jacques. He knew that the correct answer. Congratulations, Richard. He knew that the correct answer is John Lennon, of course. And Victoria Jones with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, and I knew that. I mean, that's my boy from my town.
Yeah. Yeah, you're literally from your town.
Literally from
you're
my
from
town.
You're from Liverpool.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, Liverpoolian. And he was always my Beatle.
Yeah, he was a good man. The world got a little dimmer that day.
It did get a little dimmer that day, yes.
So,
yes.
So speaking of dimmer, what's up with George W. Bush?
Well, yeah, I know. Well, he announced today that, or rather his press secretary announced today that, and I actually thought this was important news, that today is the release of this year's Barney Cam. So those of us who are animal lovers will have another opportunity to watch the Barney Cam. I thought you'd want to know that.
Oh, I'm just all a Twitter.
I thought you'd want to know. I thought you'd care.
My beating heart, Victoria.
I asked a question on your behalf today. Those of you who are radio talk show hosts, I said that I was talking to radio talk show hosts this morning, and they were telling me, as they were, that they thought it was inappropriate of the president to laugh yesterday after he said that things were bad in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck this morning how people were responding to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Tony Snow whether he agreed.
Mm-hmm.
I was then subjected to a diatribe.
Oh, really? He slapped you upside the head verbally?
And yes, and he gave me an exposition, furthermore, on the president's position on Iraq and the president's love for the troops, the president's love for America. And basically, I started to feel pretty unpatriotic for raising the issue, I can tell you.
You're kidding.
Well,
he never actually. I mean, here's
no,
the.
No, he never answered the question.
Yeah, here's the clip for our listeners.
Sincerity about changing course.
It's bad in Iraq.
That help?
There you go. It's bad in Iraq. That help?
Yeah.
I think he was frankly nervous. I think that, you know, some people laugh when they're nervous.
Well, I
do
too. So why not say it was a nervous laugh?
Yeah, but
you can't admit to nerves in the leader of the free world. That'd make all of us a little bit more nervous, wouldn't it?
I guess. I don't know. So.
So other than that going on, the president met with congressional leaders, bicameral, bipartisan leaders today to talk about the Iraq Study Group report.
Mm-hmm.
And he
has essentially said that he's going to ignore the advice that he talked to Syria. He's going to ignore the advice that he talked to Iran. And Dick Cheney is going over in the back door and talking with Saudi Arabia. And the Saudi Arabian government now in the news today is fueling or funding the Sunni insurgency. The guys who are doing a lot of the suicide bombing and setting off, you know, the car bombs and whatnot. And we have a proxy war here between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and we're clearly taking the side of Saudi Arabia.
Apparently we are. It is indeed fascinating to see how it's playing out. Of course, none of this could be in any way admitted to by anyone, and you would be accused of being a conspiracy theorist for airing it.
Well, except that it's pretty obvious. I mean, isn't it? There was... Oddly, there was no discussion of Saudi Arabia in the Iraq Study Group report, other than, you know, we need to get people in the region involved. But the Saudi, I mean, there's several news stories out today about how Saudi Arabia, how not the government, not officially, but how very wealthy people inside Saudi Arabia, Wahhabists, people who are, you know, aficionados of this extreme right-wing Islam sect, Sunni sect, are funding the Sunni extremists inside Iraq.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, this is exactly why those of us who were opposed to the war in the first place said, don't go into Iraq. We said that there will be house-to-house combat. We were ridiculed. We said you're going to end up with a regional conflict between Shia and Sunni, and you have the Sunnis on the western border of Iraq in the form of Saudi Arabia, the south and the west, and you have the Shia on the north and the eastern border in the form of Iran. And this is going to end up a battle between the two, not to mention what it's going to do with the Kurds up in the north and how it's going to start destabilizing Turkey.
And it seems that you were prescient.
Well, small consolation.
Exactly.
And any other news coming out of Washington, D.C. here today, Victoria?
Congress goes home today. It's the end of the Do-Nothing-Nothing-Nothing Congress, even bigger than the Do-Nothing Congress. That will be attempts by Senator Reid and Congresswoman Pelosi to try and stop the congressional pay raise. We don't know at this moment how well that's going, but they're trying to put a provision in. Basically, it's an anti-pay raise provision.
Now, for our listeners who don't know, the Congress will automatically get a $3,300 or $3,600 pay raise this year unless they pass a law saying that they don't get that $3,600.
Right, and it's a must-pass bill, and the bill provides funds to keep the government running. So this bill has to pass, but they're going to try and add this anti-pay raise provision to it. So it's touch and go.
Yeah, it's largely symbolic, but it's a very, very potent symbol, I think.
It is.
Yeah, indeed. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for the report.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. We'll be talking about cracking the political code when we come back from this break. 56 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, you know, we plot for clean elections and national health care and let's get the lead out of the gasoline, stuff like that. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. And Johanna von Delling is with us. Johanna is my editor at bkconnections.com at Barrett Kohler, the publisher that published Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we're working on a new book called Cracking the Code, about unraveling how political communication happens. And Johanna and I are going to have a conversation about this today, and you know, we'll see how this goes. Maybe we can shed some light on some things for all of you listening. Hey, Johanna, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. So we're going to flip roles here. You'll be the interviewer, and I'll be the interviewee. So let me hand the microphone to you, as it were.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, you contacted me several months ago and said that you were interested in writing a book applying neuro-linguistic programming to politics. And that sounded really intriguing, and I want to hear today more about that and basically start from the top. What's the big idea for the book?
Sure. Well, the main concept for the book is that there is a lot of there's a lot of incompetent communication going on politically on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's some very, very, very deliberate and conscious and intentional and powerful communication going on in the political arena. And up until I'd say even as we speak, most of the really competent political communication that's been going on, very intentional, has been coming out of the right. It's been coming out of Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz and the work that they did that is grounded in NLP and other allied fields, starting all the way back in the 1980s. And, you know, with the Reagan Revolution, and then certainly in I believe it was 94, Newt, you know, storming the gates of Congress during the Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
And they very carefully form how they speak, what they're speaking, and to whom they're speaking. And so my goal in putting together this book is to illuminate for people, to share the story with people, to give people a good grasp of both the nature of this communication, you know, how this is all working, how people communicate, how we understand, how we think, how we grok the world, how we get things, and how to become an unconsciously competent communicator. That is, how to be as good at communication as some of the people on the right. Because people on the left, by and large, in my experience, have not taken the time to do the homework. Frankly, the people on the right weren't taking their time to do the homework back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, they were running around saying things, you know, that were viewed by Americans as right-wing fringe stuff. They're saying those same things now, but it's not being viewed as right-wing fringe stuff because they've learned different ways to say it. For example, instead of talking about the ending the estate tax, they talk about ending the death tax,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a whole science to this that goes back lots of, you know, many decades. Is this the kind of thing that the average reader can learn how to do, or do we have to spend a lot of time trying to pick it up?
This is absolutely something that the average reader can learn how to do, and I really want to target two people with this book, two groups of people. One, in the very small way, are those people who are involved in the political milieu. I'm hopeful that they'll collect tools from it, you know, politicians, political consultants, folks like that. But the larger picture, I want to reach out to all of the political activists out there, which should be all of us.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are from folks who are having a conversation with their brother-in-law over dinner over the water cooler at work, to discussions with their friends, their spouse, their you know, whatever it may be, and help them have more competent communication about politics and a better framing of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this transition from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence that I want to make. People start out unconsciously incompetent. They don't realize that they don't know how to communicate. We're all the time trying to communicate, and we're all the time trying to use that communication as a way of achieving something, of achieving some goal, of persuading people, basically. People sometimes say, oh, wait a minute, this is all about manipulation. Yes, at a certain level. Because, you know, you go into a store and say, here's a dollar, give me a candy bar. Is that manipulation? It's an exchange. It's an attempt to get something. You're giving something to get something. So good communication functionally is about trying to accomplish something. It's about trying to, you know, whether it's communicating an idea or a concept or eliciting a behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So most people start out unconsciously incompetent. They don't know that they don't know how bad they are at communicating.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of this does, you know, could sound like manipulation to people, and I think certainly a lot of people would agree that the kind of thing that Frank Luntz is doing or that Newt Gingrich is doing is manipulation. What's the difference between what you want to teach people how to do and what these sort of professional spinmeisters are doing?
Well, two things. First of all, I want to give the average person the toolkit so that they can understand how to personally become better communicators.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich are not at all interested in that. Although Newt, with his memo about language, his famous language memo, in which he said, you know, whenever you refer to Democrats, there was a whole collection of negative adjectives, and whenever you refer to Republicans, and there was a whole collection of positive adjectives. And he did a whole videotape to train Republicans on this. It was pretty straightforward about that. But that was... They were never about giving people the toolkit. What they were about was taking a couple of the tools and using them to establish frames that were, in large part, frankly, lies, and using them to promulgate those. You know, for example, I went back and I deconstructed the Newt's contract with America. And if you look at the legislation that the contract with America was pointing to, six of the 10 items were basically one thing. Tax cuts for the rich would accomplish six of those 10 things in Newt's mind. I mean, it was all about packaging. So I'm suggesting that I would like people to understand these tools at a deep and real and meaningful level, so that when somebody tries to manipulate them, whether it be on the left or the right, they can immediately spot that. They can hear that story coming down the road. They immediately know, hey, wait a minute, this is, you know, whatever it is. This is an attempt to communicate, or this is an attempt to miscommunicate, to influence. This is an attempt to influence that I'm going to go along with, that makes sense to me, or this is an attempt to influence that I'm going to resist. Being conscious of the attempt to influence happening is, in my mind, half the battle.
Okay, what is the difference between communicating? You're talking about this book would be useful for people, you know, talking to somebody over dinner around the water cooler. Is there a difference between talking one-on-one with people and trying to communicate and persuade them than talking with groups?
Yes, yeah, and there are two points that I want to make. The first is the difference is the transition from unconscious incompetence to conscious competence. Or unconscious competence, and the other is the way that people understand things, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and so let me just break this answer into these two pieces.
Okay.
The first is that we start out not knowing that we don't communicate well. Then somebody comes along, like I'm going to do with this book, and says, no, wait a minute, here's how people communicate. Here's how people understand the world. Here are the different ways that different people understand the world, experience the world, and experience communication. So they become conscious of the fact that there is a toolkit here that they don't know how to use. Then they become consciously incompetent. Then they start using those tools. They start practicing them. And I hope by the end of this hour, by the end of this day, you and I will have had a conversation that will have delivered at least one good solid tool or a set of tools to folks that they can practice with and perhaps even talk about on our message boards. And so they become consciously competent. They are doing it. It's working. But they know that they're doing it. So they're consciously competent. And it's like riding a bicycle. You know, that's that point where you're riding the bicycle, but you know, dad is still holding the seat kind of thing, and the front wheel is still wiggling like crazy. And then he lets go of the seat, and okay, I'm consciously riding this bicycle, and I think I'm doing this. Yeah. And then you make the transition from that into, hey, look at no hands. You know, I know how to ride a bike. And that's unconscious competence. That's where, you know, that's how most of us drive, for example. We don't think about driving. We are not thinking about it, so we're unconscious about it, but we're competent at it. And so my goal is to help people make the transition from unconscious incompetence all the way through to unconscious competence. And the first step is highlighting for them, telling them the story, giving them the tools. And the first tool has to do with understanding how people hear things, how people see things, and how people get things. So we'll talk about that right after the break, if that's okay with you, Johanna.
Sounds great.
Okay. We're talking with Johanna von Delling of BKConnection.com, Barrett Kohler Publishers. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 16 minutes past the hour right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio. Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 21 minutes past the hour. I'm talking with Johanna von Delling. She is my editor over at Barrett Kohler Publishers. They published my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we'll be publishing, coming up in the fall of 2007, my new book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And we're talking about that book. Johanna, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom. Well, before the break, we were talking about how what you want to do with Cracking the Code is help readers and listeners go from transition from unconsciously incompetent to consciously competent. And then in order to do that, they have to understand that people communicate differently, they feel differently. differently, experience life differently. Can you talk about the sort of different categories of ways in which people communicate and,
sure.
and how they function?
There are we experience the world through our nervous system. And, you know, if we were absent, our ability to see, to hear, to feel, to notice balance, gravity, we actually have a sense, you know, it's our inner ear, a sense of gravity, our ability to smell, our ability to taste. If we were absent all of those, we would have no experience of the world existing even. So all internal experience begins as some sort of external experience that we then internalize. And we have different ways then of encoding and storing and using that information. And most people rely primarily on one of their sensory systems. And they use that sensory system as the primary way of experiencing the world and also as the primary way of storing their own internal metaphors, their own internal memory structures of what the world means and what you know, how things are. There are, and the three primary ones that people use are visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, or feeling. Our sight, our hearing, and our feeling. Now, there is a small subset of people who have as their primary system taste or smell. I actually have a friend who would say things like, we used to do business together, he would say things like, you know, I love the flavor of that idea. And he literally would say that. And this was a guy who weighed 350 pounds. And so it was, you know, it kind of caught him. You know, it's a tough one. And, in fact, I've often thought about writing a book about that. You know, it's people who sort by food. But that's a whole other, that's a digression. But most people, it's either visual, auditory, or kinesthetic. And as their primary system, we all have all of them available to us. But there are those three primary ones. And a visual person, a person whose primary experience of the world is visual, will reveal that by the way they speak. They will say things like, I see what you're talking about. Yes, that's clear to me. And in fact, they'll say on the phone, I'll see you later, you know, when they're hanging up the phone. You say, what? How can you see me now? You know, we're here. We're talking. But a visual person will use visual metaphor. They also tend, in their physicality, they tend to stand up straighter. They tend to be more concerned with their appearance. They're usually the kind of every hair in place kind of person. And they tend to hold their head back, hold their chest out, you know, it's just this kind of up, you know, in the world. They're to get their eyes as high as possible. Auditory people, the second category, and visual people in our culture represent about more or less 70% of people. There's some debate about what the percentage is, but it's a majority. Auditory people primarily experience the world through sound and through language. And they give this away by saying things like, yeah, that sounds good to me. I like the sound of that. That sounds like a great idea. Yes, I hear what you're saying. I'll talk with you later. You know, when they're wrapping up a conversation, and they store stories more than storing pictures. Like the visual people, primarily create metaphor that's visual. Auditory people will primarily create metaphor that's auditory or that's story based. And then there are people who are kinesthetic, who experience things through their feelings. And the auditory people, by the way, are probably 5, 10, 15%. It's really hard to know of our population. The kinesthetic people are 5, 10, 15%, maybe as much as 20% of our population. And kinesthetics understand the world through their feelings. They translate things into a gut sensation. They'll say things like, yeah, I get it, what you're talking about. That's a solid idea. I have a good sense about this. This really feels good to me. And when they're hanging up the phone, they'll say things like, you know, I'll catch you later. Stay in touch. You know, good reaching out to you. I got an email the other day from a fellow who very, very kinesthetic. He said, you know, we need to reach out to these people. You know, and this was a comment that he made. So that's the world that he lives in, is one where touching people is important, whereas somebody, a visual person, would want to see people, and an auditory person would want to, you know, talk to people. And, pardon my computer. It's warning me that I have to catch an airplane here in an hour. And so, you know, these are the three primary ways that people understand the world. Now, the key is, and this gets back to the original question that you asked about the difference between communicating with individuals and communicating with groups. The key with individuals is you want to try to talk to people in their own representational system. So a visual person, you'd use visual metaphor, auditory person, auditory metaphor, kinesthetic person, kinesthetic metaphor. With a group, it becomes quite different. And we can get into the details of that right after this break.
Okay.
Great. We're talking with Johanna von Delling. She's an editor, the editor at Barrett Kohler, BarrettBKConnection.com, the website, about my new book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. 27 minutes past the hour, right here on the Tom Hartmann radio program, The Real Free Speech Zone. And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 34 minutes past the hour. I'm talking with Johanna von Delling, who is my editor over at Barrett Kohler Publishers, the company that published Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, a book that came out this year. And we are discussing a book that we're still working on, and that will be coming out in the fall of 2007, called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion, a book that I'm writing. And Johanna and I are just going through some of the things on this for your edification as well as ours. And also, if any of you who are listening, if you have any questions about any of the stuff that I'm talking about, give us a call. We'll pop it on the air. Maybe, you know, there's some roads we should wander down here, to use a kinesthetic metaphor. I suppose it could be a visual one, or some directions we should lay our sights on, or some stories we should explore. It's using multiple metaphors. Johanna, welcome back.
Thank you very much. A few minutes ago, we were talking about what you're trying to do in Cracking the Code, this new book, is helping readers move to become consciously competent. And in order to do that, they have to understand that people experience the world visually auditorily or kinesthetically, and then there are some other categories. The question that I would have about this is, are people just one of these categories? Do they, are they lots of different, you know, different pieces? And if so, how do I manage all of this as somebody who's not, you know, a natural communication expert? How do I juggle all these different things I need to keep in my head?
Juggling, a good kinesthetic metaphor.
I'm pegged.
There you go. See, that's how we give ourselves away, is with our use of language. Excellent question. We all have all of these senses available to us. Some people are very rigidly locked into one mode, but that's really, frankly, quite rare, and it can be even a little disabling. One of the things that I see, that I used to see back when I would do consulting work with schools and things, when I was writing on attention deficit disorder and education, are kids who are, for example, extremely kinesthetic. My son being one of them, who have a difficult time in the public schools because they don't teach in a kinesthetic fashion. There's almost no kinesthetic component to public education. There's no doing. It's all listening or watching. And so for kids who have to do things in order to know them, it can be a real challenge. But I would suggest that, you know, all of us have all of these abilities. It's just that most of us have one primary system as our primary filter. And then behind that, there are secondary filters and tertiary filters. For example, my primary way of knowing the world is through my ears, is auditory. It's probably why I enjoy doing radio. It's why I started out in radio. I think it's also why I can write reasonably well and love to read, because that's all auditory. It's happening inside my head, but I actually hear it inside my head. When I'm writing, I'm hearing my own voice going out on the page. And when I'm reading, I'm hearing the voice of the author and the characters. And, you know, I don't know if that's the experience of people who are visual or not. I know my wife, who is, you know, Louise, who is very, very visual, reads about twice as fast as I do. And I've never had this conversation with her. I probably will now. But my guess is that she's reading and grabbing the content, just, you know, getting the content, making the pictures in her mind. And I've added a step to it, that I'm making up the sounds. You know, I'm sub-vocalizing. And in fact, in the speed reading course, the Evelyn Wood course, you know, I took one of those back 30 years ago. The first thing they teach you to do is to stop sub-vocalizing, to stop, you know, sounding things out in your, a lot of people actually even move their tongue a little bit, or their vocal cords as they're reading. So, And for another, for example, our kids, we have three kids. One is quite visual. In fact, she's a graphic artist. One is very kinesthetic, you know, my son that I mentioned. And one is primarily auditory, our youngest. And again, there's not a, you know, a hierarchy, a good or bad to any of this. This is just how we all are. And I remember one Christmas, we were all together. This was 4 or 5 years ago. And we were trying to decide what movie to go to. We were going to go out and see a movie. And the newspaper was on the table in front of us. And our visual daughter was saying, well, this looks like, you know, this looks like a good movie. I'd like to see that one. And the auditory one is saying, yeah, that's okay with me. That sounds fine with me. And our son is like, well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. And the oldest is saying, but, you know, just pick one. Just, you know, which one looks best to you? And he's like, well, I don't know. And all of a sudden I got it. And I said, Justin, which one feels right to you? And he pointed to one and he said, well, that one. And you know, he knew which one felt right. Uh-huh. But nobody had asked him that question. Uh-huh. And so it's a matter of, you know, at the level of individual communication, try to step into another person's world and communicate to them using the metaphors that they use. So if I'm talking to somebody who's very kinesthetic, I'm going to use language about getting things or having or holding or you know, the language of using your hands, basically, or experiencing your body. On the other hand, if I'm talking to somebody who's primarily visual or somebody who's primarily auditory, I'm going to use that kind of language. When we get to talking with groups, though, and communicating with groups, then we have to be multimodal. And that's why in our very, and I'm sure you caught this, Johanna, because you're familiar with this stuff, when we first started out our communication, this conversation about 30 minutes ago, I was saying things like, you know, my goal is for people to have a clear vision of this toolkit that we're talking about, to hear the stories of it, and to have a good solid sense of how they can use these things in the world. And I thought that you know, what I'm doing with that is trying to reach, you know, so the auditory people are going, oh, he's got something for me. The visual people are going, oh, I see what he's talking about. Auditory people are going, yeah, I hear what he's saying. And the kinesthetic people are saying, yeah, I can get this, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah, is there a difference between communicating with people that you think will already agree with you and people who you think are not likely to agree with you? I mean, is it harder? Do you need to use different tools to persuade the unpersuaded?
Well, first of all, my goal is not always persuasion, it's understanding. I think that's one of our first goals is to, because if people truly understand situations or positions, then they persuade themselves. It's not like we're an external force that's going to make people think a certain thing. When people really have a solid understanding of something or clearly see it, hear the stories about something, then they go, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Now I get that. But yes, with somebody who is antagonistic to an idea, it becomes particularly important to present it in a way that they can understand and that makes sense to them. And we have a couple of callers with some thoughts on this and some questions on this. Shall we bring them in here?
Yes, please.
Sure. Scott in San Diego, you're live and on the air.
Well, good morning, Tom. Always a pleasure talking with you and your guest.
Thank you, Scott.
Tom, when I read, I'm a writer also. When I read, I see movies.
Really?
When I write, I try to convey a more visual type. I write instructional manuals for computers and designing software and stuff, and I try to convey more of a visual feel so they can actually see the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I provide some illustrations, but primarily text. But it's for me, when I read a lot, over 1,000 words a minute last time I was tested.
Mm-hmm.
I literally see the movie play out. So when I'm reading your book, Walking Your Blues Away, I can see the action taking place in front of me.
That's interesting, because I visualize virtually nothing. You know, it's all story to me.
Now, the second thing that was interesting, and that's what struck me about it, was that I've been listening to your program for a long time, almost since it first came out. I listened to it a lot, and I finally got the message behind the message, and it came to me verbally, but then I immediately saw it. The message that came to me verbally was, Tom is the good shepherd. And then I saw you literally on a path with a whole bunch of sheep being the shepherd and protecting the flock. It was really clear.
Yeah,
so the first thing was auditory. The second thing was visual.
Yeah, but I'd say it sounds to me, being an auditory, like you're primarily visual, and that's not a metaphor that I would use to describe myself. I think of myself again auditorily. I think of myself as a person in a room with people having a conversation, rather than having a protective role. But that's fascinating, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Ron in Davis, California. We just have a minute before we have to take a break. Ron, what's up?
Yeah, we need about 4 hours in this, Tom, but there's a very important thing. I've studied brain neurochemistry quite a bit, and all sensory input, be it auditory, et cetera, olfactory, whatever, has to go through a component in the limbic system, has to go through the thalamus.
Right, through the thalamus, yeah.
Yeah, and they get that, so the entire emotional center gets first shot at all information, then within a thousandth of a second, it's transferred up to the cortex.
Right.
And then you can express it through your, the ways you mentioned, but I think you should really consider that, because if it was a hot button in me, I could express it auditorily, visually, whatever.
Right.
But the thing is, what do you do with the heat of the emotions that are always there before the cerebral cortex kicks in?
Well, the people who are manipulators, I mean, if you think of the Willie Horton ads, Bush was using, the fear of racism, and for that matter, the more recent ones with Harold Ford, using, that racist emotion, which at its core is a protective emotion, actually.
Yeah, actually, it's not a racist emotion. It's just fear, hate,
yeah,
et cetera.
Well, it's fear, and it's I want to protect my community, my own, and my family.
That's where the amygdala kicks in.
That's right, yeah.
Yep.
We'll get into that when we get back from this break. Let me talk about that a little more. Ron, thanks for calling and raising that. Johanna, stick around.
Yes.
Okay, we'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
I love this song. This is my dad's favorite song. He played it at his funeral. And this weekend I'm going back to Michigan to see my mother and my brothers. So it's anyhow, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Andrew Dunn, Clay Kaplis, Lauren Kirshner at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Friday afternoon here. 51 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Johanna von Delling, who's my editor over at Barrett Kohler Publishers. They published Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And we have a book coming out this coming year, 2007, the fall of this year. It's going to be 9 months or so before this book is available. It's not even, in the catalogs yet or online. It's going to be called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And Johanna, where were we?
We were talking about how communicating to individuals requires understanding whether they're visual, auditory, or kinesthetic, but that communicating to groups requires one to speak the speaker to be multimodal, which I'm guessing is a combination of all of these.
Yes.
And it was really helpful to me earlier when you were explaining how you were able to communicate with your son who's a kinesthetic, when you asked him how he felt, and then he was able to respond to that. Can you give some examples of how multimodal communication around a particular political message, since this book would be about the politics of this, perhaps, healthcare, the minimum wage, the war in Iraq?
Yeah, excellent question. Any of those three, and virtually any political story, or any political position, rather, can be reduced to a human story. It can be reduced to the story of humans, of families, of individuals. And so the extent, and here I'm starting with my own preferred system, right, the auditory system, but nonetheless, the extent to which you can convey a concept in the context of an individual story is the extent to which it'll have power. Very often, good writing, even good journalistic writing, The Wall Street Journal, for example, has some of the very best journalistic writing in the country, and they have forever. Their editorial policy is crazy, is insane, but they hire some of the best writers. And they almost always start their stories out with the story of a person. They'll start out, they had yesterday or the day before, there was a piece about healthcare in the United States, and it starts out by telling the story of a woman with lupus. And, you know, how she's melting down. And then they get to the fact that she's melting down because she can't go to see the doctor. She can't go to see the doctor because her, even though she has insurance, she can't afford to pay the copay and the deductibles. And then that gets into a whole discussion about how our healthcare system is broken. That's the level at which I would do it. I would always try to take an issue and frame it in the context of a story and then tell that story in a way that it evokes a picture of an individual. We always relate to individuals. The two units that we most readily relate to are individuals and families. And so if you can, but particularly individuals. So if you can build a story, here's how this is going to affect, you know, my mom on Social Security. This is, or your mom on Social, you know, whatever. This is how this is going to affect, you know, this woman in Kansas who has lupus. This is the consequence of it. And do it in a way that paints the picture, that describes the scene. I mean, in that Wall Street Journal article, they talked about, and it wasn't an attempt at persuasion, but it was an attempt at informing, and that's the first step in, you know, ultimately in persuading. It talked about what she looked like. It talked about what her home was like. You know, so you get the sense of this picture of this very middle-class home. You hear this story of this very middle-class home, and in fact, it was a story about how the middle class is really caught in the middle. There's the very wealthy who can afford the huge deductibles or even very, very expensive insurance, and then there's the working poor and the poor who have nothing virtually. But there's this huge middle class, too, who are just being, you know, thrown into that category at the bottom. So that's what I would do.
And that's an example of being multimodal? Or,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you are telling a story, so a person can convey the story. You are, well, for example, again, back to the Willie Horton ad that, you know, our last caller, you know, brought up the thing about how about the power of fear and the limbic brain and the, you know, and the you know, how things get filtered through our emotional brain before they reach our, and first they start actually in our reptile brain, that's where the thalamus is, and then through the limbic brain and then into the cortex, our thinking brain. And the Willie Horton ad was showing images of a murderer that looked scary and pointing out that the guy was a murderer, telling the story that he was scary, and then morphing those images into Michael Dukakis. And so by the time, and usually using visual modalities, they would use, it was actually a series of two sets of ads. And so for a while they would do these ads with Willie Horton in black and white with a particular type of music behind him. And then a few weeks later there was a series of ads with Michael Dukakis in black and white with the same kind of music behind him. Those had become anchors. They had become physiological. People experienced them as feelings. Those pictures and sounds produced a particular feeling set. That's called an anchor. And so once you evoke the anchor, then you can attach it to something else. So they basically caused people to look at Michael Dukakis and experience the feeling that they felt when they were looking at and thinking about and getting the story of Willie Horton. And that's why it was so devastatingly effective. And frankly, I wish people had been immunized to it. Johanna, it's a useful conversation?
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your great questions. Good talking with you, and we will talk soon. Johanna von Delling of Barrett Kohler, bkconnection.com, the website. And our new book is going to be called Cracking the Code, my new book, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. It'll be out this fall. Thanks so much for being with us all this week, my friends. We'll be back next week. Remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vasily Grafkin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us the plug? The phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people...